This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Hi, this is Jason from Seattle. The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like you and me. If you'd like to donate to support the show, what are you waiting for? Visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, I'm Jesse Thorne, and this is The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.
Radio sweetheart on the airways, it's the sound of young America.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, more audio from our trip to the Bumbershoot Music and Arts Festival in Seattle, Washington. On this podcast, Janine Garofalo.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome to the show, Janine.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I read on the internet that at your you won't believe some of Barack Obama's outrageous background. No, I read on the internet that at your first ever stand-up comedy show, you wrote all of your material on your arm and hand.
That is true. Fascinating story. Fascinating story.
I also read on the internet that you were surprised that you got a stronger reaction from the fact that you were reading it off of your arm and hand than your actual material.
Well, I started doing stand-up when I was a junior in college, and I really didn't have much material to speak of, but I wanted to write bullet points of what I wanted to get to, and I just jotted down buzzwords or what have you on my hand and arm. And apparently...
Buzzwords and what have you?
What have you?
Web 2.0, social media.
I wrote the actual phrase, buzzwords and what have you, on my arm, and I have since had it tattooed to my forearm. But I guess the audience found it funny that I was... because it was natural, the way I was doing it, which when I did it again later, because somebody said, you should do that, and unfortunately I took that advice. You should never take advice in the world of stand-up, but... And it was false, and so it never got the reaction that it did, doing that, because there was something very, I guess, amusing about the real motion of me looking at my arm. But I've since just written stuff in notebooks and on little scraps of paper, which I still to this day. I've been doing it 23 years now, which is, where does the time go, huh? Where does it go? I can't believe, but I still bring a notebook. Whether I look at it or not, I just need it for security purposes.
What got you onto the stage? What was the impetus?
Alcohol. Alcohol. No, I just wanted to be a stand-up comic for my career. I mean, as my job. As a kid, I was just a real fan of the form of stand-up comedy, and I would listen to stand-up comedy albums and memorize them. And then Letterman came on when I was in high school, and I thought, I definitely want to write for Letterman and live in New York. And then by the time I was a junior in college, I thought, no, I would like to write for myself and do stand-up. And that was the career path I started following.
A lot of comedians, I interview so many comedians on the show, and a lot of comedians tell me that they decided to be funny because they had, a big family, and they were always topping each other at the dinner table or something like that. But from what I read about your background, it seemed like it was almost the opposite.
No, there's no one of those stories like I had to be funny because I was the fat kid. Well, A, I was the fat kid, but I've met very few hilarious fat kids. You know what I mean? That's this off-trotted out narrative that you read in people's
Frankly,
bios,
children in general are not that funny.
As if that's going to prevent anyone from bullying you. Like, if somebody's about to smack you in the face and you just really zing them with a one-liner and, hey, this kid's all right. that I've never seen happen. I don't think any of you have ever seen in the schoolyard setting any hilarious outcast that really wins over the bullies.
But, here's your satin baseball jacket. Yeah, you're in the game.
Come on, join us. But there was, you know, my background is incredibly garden variety. There's just no dysfunction really besides the garden variety kind to speak of. There's no one of those classic stories that would lead me towards stand-up. It was just a genuine love of stand-up, which actually, if I can really think of where it might have been traced from, and this is not a dysfunctional story, I was having a slumber party, and my dad was at his wit's end what to do with us, and Take the Money and Run was on, a Woody Allen film, and my father said, you kids watch this, you know, and he was cooking us something, and I just fell in love with Woody Allen. That was around 1976 or 77 or something like that. We were one of the first families for testing HBO in New Jersey, and we got to see things that maybe weren't on regular TV yet. And Take the Money and Run and Bananas were on. And I just went insane for Woody Allen, and which is a lifelong love of Woody Allen to this day. And Albert Brooks and not Mel Brooks, which I don't dislike Mel Brooks, but some people think I'm talking about Mel Brooks when I say Albert Brooks, and there is a difference. But and I used to listen to Nichols and May albums and Bob and Ray and stuff like that.
I thought it was interesting that when you talked about writing on your arm and how the genuine action of you reading from your arm was so much funnier than the staged...
The fabricated version, yeah.
I think something that a lot of stand-up comics struggle with as comics is getting to a point where... You really look cold. You look like you're...
Oh, it is freezing out here. But I also noticed that this thing was too low, so I did the old... Oh, yikes! Okay. For you radio listeners, I had too much cleavage exposed. Woo!
Yeah.
Beautiful corduroy. With all the stretch marks. Corduroy boobs.
Yeah,
nice.
I'm the Tom Likas of public radio now.
Oh, Tom Likas. Isn't he awesome?
Oh, he's amazing.
So well-spoken. What an intellectual giant.
I love it when he yells something at someone.
Oh, yeah, hilarious.
Especially show me your boobs.
Well, you know, that's just one of the gems.
I'll tell you this. If I've learned anything in radio, there's nothing that works better in radio than boobs. And there's no better venue for boobs than radio.
Right, because you can use your imagination.
Exactly.
And they can be perfect. They don't have to be corduroy boobs.
Okay, the question that moments ago I was asking was... So for a lot of stand-ups, like the difference between open mic night and being a stand-up comic is finding the place where they can be sincere and genuine on stage when they're kind of doing something that's completely insincere and genuine and not genuine, which is, you know, doing this jokes that they wrote or whatever. How did you find your voice? How did you get to that place where you could be you?
Well, from the very beginning, I always talked about things that were true. I can't honestly say I delivered them in a natural way. I was very nervous. I mean, I was a heavy drinker. I mean, because of that, which became much more problematic later in life. As the ladies age, they don't metabolize the alcohol as they should. But
by rights,
I would try and find comfort on stage, be more comfortable on stage by drinking. Then I realized I didn't have to get drunk to do it. But that was about 4 years in where I made that realization of, oh, I can now relax. But I always told stories that were true. I mean, they may have been embellished for entertainment's sake, but I never did the kind of, did you ever notice or make up something like this just happened to me yesterday if it didn't. And I always had that, I guess if you're saying if that's the voice, I had that. But I didn't have the ability until about 4 or 5 years in to be myself on stage, which is strange when people used to say to me, what's that character you do on stage? Or why does your character dress like that? Which, that's how I dress. Or or sometimes, do you deliberately try and look unattractive? Yeah. That is a goal that I strive for on a daily basis. Barbara Walters actually asked me that once in 1996.
Well, she's known for making people cry.
Well, she tried to. I would not do it. There was a special on called Faces to Watch, 1996 or something. And one of the questions she asked me is why do you do it? Why do you try and look so unattractive? That was one. And which is... you know, one of those things of how do you dress it. And then she kept trying to hammer the death of my mom when I was a kid, which I'm not going to bring up the waterworks talking to Barbara Walters on television. And she tried every angle to get in there and get it going. But I don't feel human emotions. That's one issue. I am absolutely devoid of most normal human emotions when it comes to anyone that I know. I can cry like a baby at a commercial. You know what I mean? If there's something sad happens, but in real life, if something tragic happens to somebody that I actually know, there is just zero ability to process an emotion. So Barbara Walters was, I was going to say, shite out of luck. She was shite out of luck. You can say the Irish version of that, right?
On radio? Probably
FCC?
Not, no, but...
Yes, you can. FCC regulations, you can say.
Is that right?
Shite, yeah.
You are a professional radio broadcaster.
Yes, I was on radio, so I know all the things that you can and cannot do.
Do they make you a list? Were they kind enough to remind you of it on radio?
There are lists, yeah, that we would get at the radio station of what you could say, and there's things. It differs at 8 p.m., 9 p.m., and 10 p.m. There's more and more that you can say. But shite was always okay.
We have our own public radio list that you have of things you can and can't say. You can't talk about rap music. Mm-hmm. And you have to talk about Joan Baez.
Right. And you cannot really, you cannot call a war criminal a war criminal.
Right.
You must dance around the issue. That's in all news, I've noticed, that we coddle war criminals, white-collar criminals, and all basic other societal blights get coddled and their asses kissed, and then we mock and marginalize people like Kucinich who try and invest our society with some civility. But, I mean, George, how many ways are you going to dance around saying the Bush administration has lied? That is what blows my mind. And even National Public Radio. Oh, thank you. But they should have their FCC licenses revoked. Can you, if one is to believe ostensibly that the journalists are supposed to be serving the public good, that's why they get their FCC license.
They get the license from the FCC, which is owned by the spectrum owned by the people.
Allegedly,
yeah.
And they're supposed to be telling us the truth and enhancing the quality of our lives as citizens, and they're supposed to be good citizens themselves. Well, of course they don't do this, but and so why?
I'd like to learn karate. I've always wanted to know karate. So if there was a radio station with that would be really that would be a great service to me. Because it's free, you can turn it on.
Can you
say,
not just take a karate
move.
Class?
Here's how you do the death pinch.
Yeah, but it'd be on the radio. How would you see?
No, they'd explain it. They'd be really good at it.
I don't know if radio's the right medium for karate lessons.
They would hire professionals.
I feel like there's a better medium for it, like actually taking a class.
No. No, I'm not going to a class. Absolutely not. It's embarrassing.
Well, in the future, you've seen the commercials. In the future, there'll be a hologram you can summon up.
Janine, at the start of the thing, I'd be bad at it. So I'm not going to a class.
Right. Well, you'll have it in your own home. There'll be a hologram. You saw Minority Report. Hello, John Anderton. And there will be the holograms, and you'll just learn karate or...
Well, in this case, space karate, most likely.
Maybe.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the comedian and actress Janine Garofalo. We'll have more with Janine from the Bumbershoot Music and Arts Festival in just a minute.
Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
In the early 60s, Mal Sharp and James P. Coyle put on the squarest suits they could find, picked up a briefcase with a hidden tape recorder, and hit the streets of San Francisco with some of the craziest schemes ever imagined by man. Want to know how a drunk sailor reacts when they tell him they'd like him to star in their Verite film about a bank robbery? And that they'll be using real guns? And that no one but him will know it's a film? And that afterwards they'll all split the money? You might be surprised. Maximum Fun is proud to present Season 2 of Coyle and Sharp, The Imposters. Real put-ons from the real streets of real 1960s San Francisco, featuring James P. Coyle and Mal Sharp. A pair of real nuts. Search for Coyle and Sharp in iTunes or visit MaximumFun.org. Let's get back to the stage at Seattle's Bumbershoot Music and Arts Festival and my interview with comedian and actress Janine Garofalo.
The bulk of the beginning of your stand-up comedy career was in Boston, Massachusetts. That was a really kind of a special time in the stand-up comedy world, especially for stand-up comedy moving from the kind of classic guy in a Miami Vice sport right. coat and a Hawaiian shirt to mm-hmm. something that we might recognize as, you know, at least 30% of the stand-up
well,
comedy
actually, it
world
was more
today.
Of a going back to, you know, more of a in the late 50s and the 60s in the comedy tradition in jazz clubs, which was much more spoken word, free form, more of a social critique. And then it got a bit more homogenized as it became actually more successful when more and more comedians were successful off The Tonight Show and so forth and HBO specials in the 70s and 80s. It became more blazery. But there was this great thing that was happening in both music in the late 80s and comedy as there was more of, they used to call it college radio, but then it turned into alternative or indie rock. But there was more people sort of expressing themselves in a similar vein on stage, but in Boston, there was a very sharp division. There was the hardcore blazer, push-up elbow blazer set, and then people like David Cross and a lot of kids out of Emerson, Laura Keitlinger, Dennis Leary, actually just a lot of comics you see today. Dana Gould, most of the Simpsons writing staff came out of Boston in the late 80s and early 90s.
Were you feeling pressured either by others or just by yourself out of a need to, you know, be a professional and pay rent and so forth to work towards that 5 minutes of Carson time rather than that 20 minutes of story of a thing that happened to you?
Well, there's always pressure to do that because there was a thought that you wouldn't be successful unless you had your Carson 5 minutes and I guess now your Leno 5 minutes. I could never do it well. I don't have the ability to write concise jokes in 5 minutes that really grab a person. I'm unfortunately too wordy or too chatty for that. And there's just no way I could really do it. But I also had a day job until I was 27. So I really wasn't in financial. Plus, I had a nice dad. Yeah, be honest about that. I know people love to hate people whose parents floated them some money here, there, and everywhere. But I did have a day job until I was 27 in addition to doing stand-up, and then I finally got hired for some acting jobs when I was 27 so I could quit my day job.
Your first couple of TV jobs, you worked on the Ben Stiller Show, which was a critically beloved and cult beloved show that was cut very short. Ended up winning an Emmy after it was mm-hmm. canceled. And then you went to Larry Sanders.
No, they were the same year. When I was 27, I got cast on those two shows simultaneously. Having had no acting experience prior to that, it was an unbelievably fortuitous thing. But it came out of stand-up. I knew Ben from stand-up, and I knew Gary from stand-up. And then they both asked me to join the cast of those shows that same year, and that's when I was able to stop.
And I mean, you know, it's Larry mm-hmm. Sanders has been off the air for a while, and when it was on the air, it was on a pay cable channel, mm-hmm. but absolutely one of the top 5 or 10 sitcoms ever created for television. What was it like for you to get other acting jobs? You know, those are the kind of gigs that get you mm-hmm. other gigs because people love them and respect them. On shows that weren't the greatest show of the decade.
It was a real, it was baptism by creamy, chocolatey, non-fire. I mean, it was, having those two jobs right off the bat, fantastic. And also, I was not an actor and didn't know a lot about it. It was a great way to start. Then I went on to other things that was not even remotely similar to those. Not only did I not know everybody in the cast already socially, you couldn't improv, you couldn't change anything, there wasn't the freedom, there wasn't also the creative vision at the head of it, I did episodic stuff on certain sitcoms where it's just, sometimes I just choke on the dialogue, some of the stuff is just so poorly wrought, if you will, and the writers are so precious about you can't change one thing, and then I had a brief stint on SNL, which at that year that I was on, was at a very low ebb. I mean, it got it was bad time. It was better before I was there, and then it got better after I left.
It was specifically a totally crazy ebb.
It was just like a particularly awful time.
12,000 bizarre things happening on the show at the same time. Like,
then,
no one had any idea what that was.
And then it, you know, so I left. So that was a terrible experience, but I had to do it. If SNL asks you to do it, it's just one of those things where you feel, I just got to do it. Even though I had been told by friends that maybe this isn't the right era of SNL to do it, I did it anyway, and it just didn't work out for me. But it immediately started picking up when Molly Shannon got there. Right after, you know what I mean? It just, things started to happen, and the women on SNL have really brought it back. I mean, in a really great way.
Were you surprised when basically when you got famous? I mean, it was shortly after that Saturday Night Live. You were doing films. You were the star of a hit movie that was a big surprise hit.
Those were the days. It was a nice brief window. That was an interesting time.
Did you imagine your career building to Janine is a famous, like a movie star famous? Like,
well,
was that something
was
that was in the cards?
I don't know if I ever was ever that famous, but I never imagined I would be an actor ever anyway. But then after I quit SNL, I was told by one of the people that worked there, you're dead in this town, you know, you never work again. And then, thank God, like 2 weeks after, I got cast in Truth by Cats and Dogs, which was helpful. And then there was this brief window where I could be in movies, and I worked a lot. And then around 2000, that just stopped. So it's one of those things where, wow. That was a wow! What happened? That was interesting. I never anticipated it. I didn't appreciate it enough when I was there, but now where I sort of don't do stuff like that, it feels more like I think that's what I had thought was going to happen. I'd just be sort of moderately working or something like that.
What do you get out of acting besides
money?
Getting paid? Yeah.
Money. I would get more out of it. There have been times where I've done things that the independent things or low budget things that nobody's ever seen that are quite fulfilling, and you do get a lot out of it. The part is challenging. I don't get the opportunity to really play very challenging. You know, it's not like I'm in a position where we want you to do the Emma Goldman story, the Margaret Sanger story, whatever it is, you know, where you'd be like, wow, this is fulfilling. Or to be working with Steven Soderbergh or something.
I've got this amazing script about Harriet Tubman, and I think Janine Garofalo is the woman to play the part.
There'd be an issue with me being Caucasian, but that your point is well taken. So that would be...
But would that issue be bigger than the issue of slavery? Which I'm against.
That would be something for the pundits. That would be something for the pundits to discuss.
Fair enough.
On our 24-hour news cycle.
Wait, can we? Speaking of punditry, can we talk for a minute about your window of punditry as a radio host?
Uh-huh.
Being a radio host, I mean, I'm lucky enough as a radio host to host a show where I only have to generate an hour of show a week. And the only time I ever hosted a regular talk show, I was working at XM Satellite Radio. And one of the hosts was on vacation. And at XM, they only have like 3 people per station. I was interning. And they're like, hey, can you host for a week? And I was like, okay. And it was, when you listen to the radio, it sounds so easy. And frankly, what I do is pretty easy. But that, the talking for hours on end, is an unbelievably difficult skill. What was it like for you to adjust to that challenge?
Well, I was at Air America for about 2.5 years, and we did Monday through Friday, 8 to 10, sometimes 8 to 11 p.m. And at the beginning, I stuttered like crazy. As soon as, oddly, you know, I'm a fairly articulate person, I guess. I don't know if I am or not, I guess,
you're a very articulate person.
Compared to articulate people, maybe not. Compared to the average person on the hills, yes. Very very articulate. But
a rock is very articulate compared to the average person on the hills.
That Caucasian youth vernacular is driving me out of my mind. I don't know how it has swept the country. I mean, I will get back to your point, but I had to watch The Hills recently because I did a staged reading of The Hills at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in L.A., and I played Lauren Conrad, so I bought the DVDs of season 2 because I knew of The Hills, but I hadn't seen it. I watched the DVD of season two. I really, I don't know what to say about what I'd seen or what or why it was happening. And I don't understand the way that now, it's not Valley speak per se, because everybody does it. It's just like lazy. You know what I mean? That is so random. Random's a big one. They like to say the word random. But this lazy, they say like every 15 minutes so they don't have to actually commit to a thought or an idea or be embarrassed by being passionate about something. Anyway, that sidebar, they'll edit this out. But it was a hard adjustment to work at Air America initially because I found that as soon as we went on air, I would start stuttering unbelievably, and it would be difficult to catch thought. I got better at it. And I also, there was an enormous amount of research and learning I had to do for doing a political show for like 4 hours a night, 5 nights a week. But it was it was one of the best experiences I've had and one of the jobs I'm proudest of that I've ever done. And Sam Cedar, my co-host, a truly amazing person and one of the smartest people I've ever met and gotten to learn from, who I think still works at Air America on Sundays. They keep shafting him. I don't know what they...
Excellent radio host as well. Very funny guy.
He's very good. Sam Cedar's very, very good. And Rachel Maddow, who's now on MSNBC a lot, is another wonderful Air America person who the mainstream media desperately needs. I mean, thank God.
What did you learn about doing radio from jumping into it when Air America was launched with this idea of it being a whole new thing, or a, mm-hmm. you know, it was a very big idea type of launch. What did you learn from actually, you know, getting behind the microphone every night?
Well, the idea behind Air America was a liberal talk, which is basically reasonable, honest talk. You know, as opposed to right wing regressive conservative talk, which has dominated the airwaves for the last 30 years and has been incredibly instrumental in disinforming at least half the population and dumbing down the society and making people more like Tom Likas. And so we wanted to have a radio station that countered all the disinformation and all the bullying that was going on. And so there was a group of people that got together to do that. Unfortunately, there was a couple of people who were grifters, shysters, con men, who raised a bunch of money and took off. One of them's in jail and one's still at large. So the radio station started at a deficit and was always behind the eight ball. And then unfortunately, because of that, over the years, they had to hire just radio management people who were apolitical, you know, just their bottom line was trying to make a profit. And the radio, it started getting away from its mission statement, and they were firing great people and hiring terrible people. And I learned that radio is just as craptastic as any other office job. And, you know, middle management radio goons are no different than network nerds. And
I imagine it took you away from the stand-up stage too. I mean, if you're on the air, those are the hours when there are stand-up comedy shows for the uh-huh. most part.
Right. I was doing much less stand-up, but also at that time I was so incredibly I had a real anger management problem that I still work on now. But the political situation since 2000, I mean, I really, since the Antonin Scalia installation of George Bush, I mean, I really thought I was going to lose my mind. And the after 9/11, the way the administration treated us and the march to war, all that stuff consumed me to a point where I didn't, what do you say about it, joke-wise? How do you find a way to talk about it? Plus, there were so many people in comedy audiences when I would do stand-up who, in their ignorance, were just, if you brought up George Bush in a critical way, just the outrage and the booing, and a couple of times myself and other comics would have to be ushered out the back of the theater space in 2002, 2003, all kinds of death threats and this, that, and the other. So it was not really worth the effort to do stand-up. But I found it very difficult to find anything funny at all. Now it's easier because I've worked on my anger management issues about it. But I still, that Phelan, Sarah Palin or Phelan, This will get the ladies, right? She's a lady. Ladies are going to vote for a lady, right, ladies? That kind of insult. You know, the Republicans just never tire of just smacking you in the face of with insults. To choose this woman that, as if women are now going to just vote because they recognize a lady on stage. And, you know, but this is a woman who is against reproductive rights and wants creationism in school. But she's a hockey mom. You know, they say that like, oh, hockey mom. Is that ka-ching? That's just...
Wait, what was that ka-ching? Was that you printing
that's
money?
That's the lever. I'm
oh,
not
that
good
was the
with
lever
sound
voting.
Effects.
Gotcha.
Ka-ching?
I didn't realize they made a ka-ching.
And money makes the sound of chunk. Right? Is that the sound of money?
You're back doing a lot more stand-up these days. I mean, you're also acting. You got a regular role on a hit television program.
On 24, torture. They love to torture on 24. Yeah, I was a fictional government operative on The West Wing, where people were nice, and now I'm a fictional government operative in the world of Jack Bauer, where people are not so nice.
We're talking about fictional people.
Fictional people, yes.
Yeah.
That's hence the word fictional that I just used twice.
Oh, did you?
Do you remember I just said fictional twice?
My apologies.
Okay.
My apologies. I'm just kind of spacing out up here. Such an easy job. Do you still get out of doing stand-up comedy what you want to get out of it? Like, does it still give you, you know...
Yes, I find it's enormously satisfying and enjoyable. I like to express myself that way. I just like to do it. It's fun. I got a lot of good friends that do it, and we can travel together and do shows together. And I'm more now, oddly, I've started a thing where I just walk into the audience now. Which I've been enjoying a lot. I don't know why, and if you come to the show tonight, I'll probably do it. It's just I just started doing it one night, and now I can't stop doing it. Just walking up and talking to an individual, which is no fun, I guess, for anyone craning their neck to turn around to see where you're talking. But
You don't do comedy for those people.
Well, it's just the one person. You've heard the expression, if I could just make one person laugh. But the,
it's like this. It's if you could just make one person crane their neck to look at you.
Yeah, then I've succeeded.
Yeah.
But I really enjoy it in a way. And, you know, I actually enjoy working on 24 very much. Very nice people. It's very fun. But I can't honestly say the part I'm playing is... I'm a computer genius FBI operative whose basic function, I guess, is to deliver expositional information for the TV audience to tell you what you either you just saw or you're gonna see. That's
do you have an enhance button? Do you also enhance things? Enhance?
Oh, I do a lot.
Do you enhance
I say
that?
Things
enhance,
I don't know
enhance.
What I'm saying at all. I am not computer savvy yet. Apparently, I can out hack Chloe O'Brien. I can get in and out of any. I can get you know what I mean. I can anybody that's gone rogue. I'll get them back. Anything I can find. Anything I can do. Anything. I don't know what I'm saying on the show. I've got post-it notes stuck everywhere, so I can just...
To be fair, you know. Though, Janine, to be fair to the producers, you do wear spectacles.
In real life, yes, I do. I do wear, so I must be smart.
Yeah.
But I do wear glasses, and I wear glasses on the show because I don't like to wear contacts early in the morning, because sometimes I have to get up at 3:50 a.m., and I don't want to put contacts in. So my character wears glasses on the show.
Well, Janine, I thank you so much for taking the time to be on The Sounding of
America.
Thank you
for having
me. It was so
me.
Fun to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find Janine Garofalo's tour, The Satiristas, online at myspace.com/satiristas. SATIRISTAS. That's it for another Sound of Young America program. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music written and performed by Dan Grayson with help from myself. Interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, and you can email me directly at jesse@MaximumFun.org. Oh, hey, our intern is Casey O'Brien, and this show was edited and actually produced and directed in Seattle by Nick White. We'll see you on the next Sound of Young America podcast. Bye-bye.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. Your social battery is precious, so make sure you're using it the way you want to. Therapy can help you figure out your social sweet spot. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. The Capital One Venture X business card earns unlimited double miles on every purchase. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/VentureXBusiness.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.